This is Talking Points, Kent's politics podcast.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of Talking Points, Kent's politics podcast. We have 2.5 weeks left to go in this general election campaign, and of course on December 12th we'll all be making our way to the polls to decide who will be running the country in 2020 and beyond. We've now had Labour and the Conservatives manifesto, so we've got quite a lot to talk about today with my co-host Paul Francis. How are you doing, Paul?
I'm good, thanks Ollie.
Good. And for those of you wondering, don't worry, I'm sure you're itching to know. Yes, Gillingham and Raynham MP Remon Chishti's cat bill is featured in the Conservative manifesto.
Hurrah!
Yeah, an issue he's not stopped talking about for the past year.
Very important, though.
Yeah, there you go. You know, the cat lovers rejoice. Paul, is it fair to say things are getting quite serious now?
Well, obviously it is for the cat vote, but yeah, I think that now we've had all the manifestos out, it does kind of mark the sort of run into polling day on December the 12th. And I think if you're keen on spotting political VIPs, I think you may see some activity on that front in Medway Towns and Kent generally over the next couple of weeks. Because what tends to happen is that the parties fan out to all parts of the country, mainly marginal seats, it has to be said, and then gravitate back towards London and the South East the closer we get to polling day. So I think we'll probably be in line for a few headline-grabbing visits.
I was going to say, because all the drama of Canterbury last week, it feels like it's been relatively quiet for local politics in Kent.
Yeah, and I guess that's inevitable sometimes. And I think one of the things that the political parties sometimes underestimate or fail to appreciate that 5.5 weeks of a campaign is quite a long time. There's a lot of time to fill in with kind of announcements, policy programmes and projects. And the more time there is, the more forensic the scrutiny tends to be. And I think that's probably why you're seeing some of the parties having difficulty getting their message across.
Yeah, and speaking of political heavyweights visiting Kent, although it feels weird to call Matthew Hancock a heavyweight. he visited Canterbury Hospital and he did speak to KMTV, and this is what he told them.
This hospital is on the up, but it's also very old and it clearly needs work. The reason that I've come to Canterbury is to say that there will be investment going into this hospital if the Conservatives are returned to office. We've got the largest hospital building programme in a generation, and it is absolutely crystal clear to me as Health Secretary that this hospital needs investment and is going to get investment.
Paul, what are your thoughts on Mr Hancock's...
Well, I think the Conservatives are still banging this drum and claiming that they're going to be building 40 new hospitals. Although I think Anna Firth, the Conservative candidate in Canterbury, chose her words very carefully when she spoke about the surprise, allegedly, visit by Matt Hancock, when she said he'd committed himself to upgrades and investment. Words which don't actually translate into a new hospital when you think about it. So I think there's some careful kind of language being deployed around this, although the Conservatives insist that they are going to build 40 new hospitals.
Well, this is the issue, isn't it? It's about making sure that you pledge things to potential voters without over-promising and then completely under-delivering if you do eventually get in power.
Yeah, and I think what was interesting about the Conservative manifesto this week was that it was quite a modest programme, actually. They didn't go into huge amounts of detail and it was kind of fairly generalised. They didn't say anything about social care because they probably remember what happened to Theresa May when she inadvertently got stuck in a rut over the dementia tax plans back in 2017. So if you look carefully at the Conservative manifesto, it's actually short on quite a bit of detail. It talks about, doesn't actually mention social care whatsoever.
Well, you sort of headed up our first topic of conversation today, which is the Conservative manifesto, released on a Sunday of all days. Is that significant in any way?
Well, we had the Lib Dems in a nightclub, so the Conservatives on a Sunday, not in a church hall. But yeah, it is quite unusual. I'm guessing they probably think that they get a bit more attention from people who might otherwise be preoccupied with work Monday to Friday. I don't think there was any great significance in it particularly, but it was an interesting choice.
There were some suggestions from some political commenters that I read, which was it makes sense to put it out on a Sunday when voters are less inclined to be reading the news, perhaps. Political commentators aren't available straight away. It's going to take a whole 24-hour news cycle to start talking about it. I don't know how much of that is tinfoil hat, really.
If that was the case, and I don't think it's particularly successful. The one thing that I found interesting was that Conservative Central Office was tweeting about contents of the manifesto, but you couldn't find it online for quite a while after Boris Johnson had finished his speech.
I think I saw you tweet out, actually, finding out if anyone actually did have a copy of it.
And I wasn't alone in having trouble locating it.
Not great design there, if you're going to...
No, it did seem a bit odd, but then again, you know, maybe it was just a kind of technical blip or whatever, but it was there eventually.
So the manifesto itself, you say it's quite general... quite slim, some people say. It's only about 56,
57... 62.
60, there we go, he's counting.
Yeah, 62 pages.
Not many, is it?
Against the Green Party, 92 pages, which left me with an ethical dilemma about whether I should print out the Green Party manifesto when I was thinking about all those trees. It was, and I think that's, again, a reflection of the fact that, the Conservatives don't want to get pinned down too much on potentially contentious policy proposals.
Is that a good thing, though? I mean, should we be, if it's going to be the manifesto for a party running the country, should they not be including as much detail as possible to give voters as much chance to understand what the party's going to do as possible?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you contrast it with the Labour manifesto, which took a completely different tack, it was kind of like a week-long political Black Friday from Labour. They're giving out stuff left, right and centre. I don't know. We talked about this before. When manifestos create a kind of certain energy in a campaign, and people like me look for kind of gaps and points of interest. But by and large, they tend to be forgotten quite soon. And, you know, I reckon that by the time people go to the polls on December the 12th, they probably won't be entering the polling station with any thoughts about, oh, yes, I remember what I read in the manifesto.
Isn't that a bit sad, though, because they should be the exact things that we are.
Yeah, I mean, I think manifestos are kind of like frame the argument in some ways. So it's about creating the right kind of impression. We talk about the optics. It's more about what it says in the round rather than necessarily specific proposals.
And we've talked about the hospitals, 40 new hospitals, which is a pledge, 50,000 nurses as well. One other thing that I picked out, and this is just one thing that feels quite Kent specific, is no new grammar schools being built under a Conservative government. A bit of a flip-flop issue for the Tories over the last decade, isn't it?
I mean, the Conservatives, there are a lot of Conservatives who think that it's a vote winner to drop the existing ban on completely new grammar schools. It's kind of an article of faith for many Conservative supporters. I think Boris Johnson is probably aware that it has the potential to be a divisive issue. When he came down during the leadership debates to Kent, I asked him about his position on the grammar schools and whether he'd be lifting the ban on them. And he didn't want to talk about it. He said his focus was on kind of equitable funding, helping make sure that the kind of those who may not have the best social... those who are kind of from poorer backgrounds had the same kind of opportunities. And some people would say, well, that's an argument for grammar schools, but he didn't really want to get into it. So in a sense, no surprise that it wasn't there in the manifesto, but that probably will disappoint some Conservatives, particularly in Kent.
Mm. And it always does feel like a Kent issue because obviously grammar schools are kind of... It's always been a contentious issue in this county, hasn't it?
Yeah, and we've had a couple of proposals recently for one by Kent County Council to develop one of these annex grammar school sites on the back of a demand for places in Sevenoaks for boys' places. And that follows on from the creation of one of these satellite campuses in Sevenoaks 2 or 3 years ago for girls, which is part of the Weald of Kent Girls Grammar School. So there are lots of people that sort of see those developments as a kind of... pushing the boundaries of the existing legislation, which doesn't permit entirely new grammar schools. And I think, you know, you will see in a few years' time those annexes actually, because obviously the numbers are going to grow, they will, in a sense, become de facto new schools.
Mm. And obviously one of the... That's one of the biggest things about this manifesto. It's slim, but it really hits its point home, which is what Boris Johnson's been doing in these debates as well, which is get Brexit done. That's kind of the overarching important facet of this manifesto, is it not?
Yes. Get Brexit done underpins everything in the Conservative campaign, basically, because they say if they get Brexit done, they can move on to some of these other proposals and concentrate on the issues that matter to people. And, of course, Brexit matters to a lot of people, but they're making this big connection between we'll get Brexit sorted, unlike Labour, who will go into a period of renegotiating a deal. And Boris Johnson is underlining that by saying he'll bring back the withdrawal bill before Christmas.
Mm. And the foreword by Boris Johnson in the manifesto, it makes that quite clear that is exactly what they're fighting against. I think I can't remember the exact number of times that Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party are mentioned in the foreword, but it's almost every paragraph.
Right. Because you've read the foreword in more detail than I did.
Perhaps too much, yeah. And I think that it is going to be quite a brutal election in that case, because they are very much attacking each other on this Brexit issue specifically.
Yes, but if you tuned into any of the kind of leaders' debates that we've been having in the last week, then I think there's a lot of people who are kind of less convinced of this kind of tit-for-tat argument, or less impressed and a bit underwhelmed by the kind of repetition of these kind of sound bites. So I think there is still time for the parties to perhaps be not in terms of getting their message across. It's going to come under more scrutiny in the run up to December the 12th,
which can only be a good thing. So we also, since we've last done a podcast, we had the Labour manifesto, one that people are touting as a radical manifesto. Yes. Is it radical, Paul?
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, I think if you equate radical with investment and spending money, then it definitely is, because it's the costings of the proposals in the Labour manifesto have been put at £82 billion a year, which is twice as much as what their 2017 manifesto costed. Mm. I think that there's a bit of window dressing around this kind of radical, bold, ambitious programme. You know, they are words you tend to see lots of parties use when they're putting forward their programme. However, you know, renationalisation, stroke privatisation of different services, huge public sector pay rise, free broadband, you know, there's a lot of goodies being promised in the Labour manifesto, which are kind of, you know, when you compare and contrast with the specifics of the Conservative manifesto, is quite significant.
Those goodies, in inverted commas, that are being given out in the manifesto, is some of that perhaps a smokescreen to the fact that the Brexit issue itself will be a contentious point if Labour were to win the power back in Westminster?
I think it's a kind of a weak point for Labour, definitely. And you could tell it's a weak point, because when Jeremy Corbyn, during one of these leaders' debates, started to say our position will be to renegotiate, and he got as far as renegotiate and the audience just started laughing, basically. So I think Labour's position on Europe and Brexit has been slightly more difficult to explain to voters, and I think in that respect then it has its difficulties for the leadership to explain properly.
And
one thing I was going to mention quickly about that was that Jeremy Corbyn did finally come out, of course, with his position on where he would be in terms of a new deal, and that would be, wait for it, drum roll, to be neutral on the new deal.
Which many have said is not a position to be neutral.
Well, his argument is he'd be a broker of the new deal and therefore it'd be better for him to stay neutral. And I thought, well, if he thought that was a good idea, why has he waited so long to declare his hand on that? And I think he's been put under pressure by voters, actually, to be more explicit about where he stands.
And forced his hand on it. Antonio Vice, who's the Labour parliamentary candidate for Tunbridge Wells, was on your show, Paul and Politics, on Friday. This was his response to the £82 billion annual spending figure in that manifesto.
I think that needs to be put in context of, effectively, our public sector has been starved of investment over the last 10 years due to Conservative and, I'm sorry to say, Liberal Democrat policies of austerity, which flew in the face of any sensible economic sort of viewpoints. And so as a result, it's time that we reinvested back in. And if you look on a European level, we're proposing around 4% of GDP to be spent on investment. That is in line with many other leading European nations. So these aren't outlandish proposals.
Paul, is is that going to... Does that money actually add up? Has anyone gone to the length of trying to work out if that's even feasible?
Well, I haven't.
Yeah. What are you doing?
Then I fail my maths O-level, so I'm not the best person with figures. But some economic experts have costed it, and I think one of the problems is that, you know, when you get into this exchange of numbers, people don't... it's very difficult to people to grasp, you know, what does 82 billion mean in terms of implementation costs? And you'd be, because Labour would say, well, renationalisation of privatised industries won't cost us anything because we'll just assume, take it back as a government asset. So I think the tit-for-tat exchanges between the parties over numbers and costings is not awfully helpful.
Talking Points, Ken's Politics Podcast.
So disinformation spread by parties, Paul, it was something you were keen on talking about this week.
Yes.
Specifically. This obviously got kind of thrust into the public eye when the Conservative Party rebranded their Twitter profile and called it Fact Check UK during the first debate between Corbyn and Johnson, as if it was some kind of authorised fact-checking site. Some have said the account should have been banned for deliberate disinformation spreading. I mean, is this the beginning of parties taking these tactics to a new level?
I think it is, actually, and I don't think anything's going to stop it. In a sense, it becomes a bit, we become a bit like America with these kind of attack ads that they used in American elections. And, you know, social media is supposed to be helpful in adding to transparency and accountability. And yet you see, you know, as you mentioned, the Conservatives deploying this way of fact checking the pledges made by Labour and pretending to be kind of an independent fact checking website. They've obviously denied it. But I do think that this is something which is, again, confusing for voters. You know, if you're looking for kind of unvarnished and kind of independent analysis of what the parties are doing, it's sometimes a bit of a grey area.
I think it's interesting. It's almost like you've got to think of it as, is this good marketing or disinformation? Because one we spoke about before was the Brexit Party leaflet. You were quite intrigued by it when it got put through a letterbox.
Yeah, the Brexit Party, I thought actually it was actually politically a very clever ruse, and that was to post kind of its leaflets, information leaflets about the party in the form of those cards you get when you've missed a parcel being delivered to your house, and it said, you know, headed Brexit Party, you may have missed this, etc.
Your Brexit has not been delivered.
And I was duped by this. You know, I was amongst those, oh, that's interesting, and I actually picked it up, and obviously thinking that I had missed a parcel and it might be a nice present someone's given me. But it's actually turned into a party political kind of leaflet, which, you know, I think that was quite clever.
I suppose the difference between doing that and something like the fact check is that it's very quickly, once you've looked at that Brexit Party leaflet, that it was clear that it was about, it was not one of those. Whereas the Conservative Party branding their Twitter as Fact Check UK could very much sell disinformation to people,
yes,
but they then might not get rectified later on.
Fake news and all that.
Fake news, exactly. Yeah. And actually one of those, again, back to your show on Friday, Ben Chapelard, who's the Liberal Democrats candidate in Tunbridge Wells, was also on the programme, and you sort of took him to task for a party leaflet basically designed as if it was a newspaper. Let's hear a bit of that now.
Our leaflet is very clearly a mock newspaper. You've got
a copy
there.
Yeah, I've got a copy of the here.
It is. On the
screen.
We produce it very regularly.
It's saying there's a big surge in Liberal Democrat support.
That's what we're finding on the doorstep in Tunbridge Wells, and reflected in last week's election.
But anyone picking this up off their doorstep would think, oh, that's a newspaper.
Well, anybody who knows Tunbridge Wells would know that that's not one of the two newspapers that is served by Tunbridge Wells, either the Times of Tunbridge Wells or the Kent Sussex Courier. Yeah,
and you've put Labour down at 12% when in 2017 they came second and third.
The bar chart is very clearly labelled, and the imprint tells you who's published that newspaper.
I mean, is that the same, on the same level of disinformation as the Twitter
account?
Well,
it's kind of it's a different way of spreading what should we call it? Disinformation. It's a bit too far to call it black propaganda. That sounds a bit too kind of Soviet.
Sounds intense. So, yeah.
But again, you know, nothing wrong, nothing unlawful, nothing in breach of the electoral laws or the electoral regulations or guidance on literature that parties can produce. But to all intents and purposes, the Liberal Democrats, and they've not just done this in Tunbridge Wells, but they've done it across a string of constituencies, sort of purporting to show that in that particular seat, usually a kind of conservative marginal, that the Liberal Democrats represent the only significant challenge, and that a vote for Labour is a wasted vote. And they dress it up as kind of, I think the Liberal Democrats one for Tunbridge Wells talked about a surge in support for Ben Chapelard, and mentioned a kind of council by-election victory where they'd unexpectedly taken a seat from the Conservatives. And then just in the tiny print at the bottom of the newsletter, you see it's published by the Liberal Democrats and nothing really to do with any newspaper.
See, that feels more deliberately like misinformation, because somebody could take that as... And saying that there's a huge surge in support, because one of the things that Ben said on your programme is that that's what they're seeing on the doorstep. Isn't that what all candidates say when they're doorstep?
Yes, and you can see it. So we touched on this before about the kind of, you know, the Twitter posts where constituents, party activists also in Nevada, fantastic response on the doorstep. This is, in a sense, a kind of printed variation on that. You know, whether people get duped by this is open to question, but, you know, an interesting tactic, shall we say.
Absolutely. And one more thing to end the episode. We need to do our jargon of the week. Paul, what's the jargon of the week?
Well, it's kind of, it's a buy one, get one free jargon of the week. So the two words I've picked out, which I don't really mean anything. Unleashed and unlocked. You know, the parties are going around talking about their plans to unleash the economy and unlock investment in the UK once they get over Brexit. I mean, I always apply the kind of, if you went into a pub and had started a conversation about the election, would you say, hey, have you heard about what the Conservative plans are going to unleash on the electorate? Or have you heard about the Labour's plans for the NHS? They're going to unlock a lot of potential. So two kind of words I'm not too keen on, and message to parties, avoid if you can.
Do you think those candidates do go into pubs and use those words?
No. Not that I've been in many pubs recently during this campaign.
Sure. Well, we don't believe that, Paul, but fine.
You can believe it.
Well, thank you so much for joining us again. Another episode of Talking Points. We'll be back next week. Have we got any ideas what could have happened, what might happen between now and next week's episode, Paul?
No, is the short answer. But I mean, I do think that, you know, we're probably in that period when we're going to begin to see kind of more political visits to Kent. And as I said earlier, if you're a VIP political watcher, keep your eyes peeled.
There we go. Thanks so much for listening. See you next week.
Talking Points, Kent's politics podcast.